Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Freedom From Religion versus Loop. Ms. Hagman.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The government's appeal raises two issues. First, whether the plaintiffs have standing to challenge Section 107(2) of the Internal Revenue Code, and second, whether that section is unconstitutional. We believe the question to both is no. I'll first address standing. Plaintiffs do not have standing for the simple reason that they have not asked for and been denied the exclusion at issue.
Well, so why should they be required to engage in a futile action in order to bring a challenge? Isn't it clear, given the plain language of 107(2), that the plaintiffs, they're not entitled to that exclusion?
A couple responses, Your Honor. Number one, standing for unequal treatment purposes, the Supreme Court has made what we think is fairly clear. It requires a personal denial, even when it is clear from the face of the statute that the plaintiff in that case would not succeed under the face of the statute. And two examples of this is Heckler v. Matthews, where there it was a male plaintiff challenging the Social Security Act that by its terms only applied to women. And the Supreme Court emphasized that there was standing in that case not because the statute was facially discriminatory, but because the plaintiff had actually engaged in seeking the benefit at issue before Social Security. Same situation in Texas versus Monthly, where the statute on its face applied to religious organizations, and the secular magazine in that case was determined to have standing, again, not because the face of the statute was limited to religious organizations, but because the taxpayer actually pursued its own tax liability by pursuing a refund claim. The Fifth Circuit interpreted Heckler v. Matthews and Allen v. Wright in the Apache Bend case on somewhat, almost identical facts as this case, to require personal denial. That's the dividing line the Supreme Court has drawn between actual injury and generalized grievance. And the district court thought it wouldn't serve any purpose to have the plaintiffs go through and file a formal refund claim with the IRS, but it does serve the purpose, Article III's purposes of limiting judicial power, respecting separation of powers, and allows the executive branch to address an issue before the court does. And in this case, it was an issue of first impression, whether any atheist could ever qualify under 107, and there's nothing in the face of the statute or any IRS guidance that would limit the exclusion to exclude an atheist minister. And of course, just to emphasize, and we brought this up, we are not arguing that the plaintiffs can't challenge 107(2). They just can't do so before personally seeking it. All they would need to do is to file an administrative refund claim with the IRS, making the argument that they believe under the face of the statute they're not entitled to it, and that in their view that's unequal treatment. And then they could proceed, as other plaintiffs have proceeded, by bringing constitutional challenges in the context of their own tax litigation, like Texas Monthly, the Droves case in the Ninth Circuit, and a number of others that we've cited in our case, in our briefs.
Do you think there's any realistic possibility that the IRS might approve that refund, given the statutory language, ministers of the gospel?
I don't think on the facts of this case that these particular plaintiffs would meet that, because there's no evidence that they have been licensed by an atheist church to be atheist ministers.
What's but an I don't atheist? Think I'm not sorry. Sure what an atheist church or an atheist minister is.
Well, in the American Atheist District Court case that we cited in our reply brief, a recent standing case, the court found that there are atheist churches. The American Atheist Organization in that case admitted that there are atheist churches. You know, the IRS's interpretations of religion and church are very inclusive because of First Amendment concerns. And as we pointed out in our brief, religion is broadly interpreted to include secular humanism, which I think is somewhat similar to atheism. And this court in The Kaufman case held that for Establishment Clause purposes, atheism is a religion. So if it's a religion, it could have the organizational criteria to be an atheist church. And in the American Atheist litigation that was resolved in the government's favor on standing grounds, the government did submit evidence that there are, in fact, atheist churches.
Are you saying that secular humanism would be considered an atheist church?
No. I was just saying it's just another example of how, you know, inclusive the IRS's interpretation of religion. It's, you know, it's broadly defined using the Supreme Court's definition that it's any religious organization where its members hold a sincere belief in a doctrine that holds a place in the lives of its members parallel to the place that God serves in traditional religions.
Can you give me an example of an atheist church?
I don't know like the name of one, but I know that in the American Atheist, we submitted evidence that there are these, I think there were newspaper articles about atheist mega churches, and it was conceded in that case, as the district court determined.
Atheist what churches?
They're called atheist mega churches.
Mega.
I think it's just mega. Large. Mega.
Thank you.
Yes, but in that case, the district court found that there have been atheist churches. But again, that it's somewhat a red herring because our point is not that they could qualify, but to, for standing purposes, under cases like Heckler and Texas Monthly, the plaintiffs would have needed to ask and be denied for the exclusion at issue because taxpayers do not have standing to challenge others' tax liability, only their own tax liabilities. They would need to litigate this constitutional challenge in the context of their own litigation.
Could we go to another issue?
The Establishment Clause issue?
Well, yes. I want to ask you about the categorical exclusions, you know, such as for seamen or government employees, mm-hmm. You know, who are living overseas. And they're clearly based on the exceptional nature of their housing requirements. How do you think ministers are comparable to those groups such that their housing also should be categorically exempt?
Historically, ministers use the parsonages for their church's convenience. The church needs and use it for religious purposes, whether it's a matter of location or a matter of what's going on in the home. Congress and the courts have recognized this, as we have throughout our brief. For example, the Eighth Circuit's Williamson case held that parsonages are provided to ministers, whether in kind or in cash, for the church's convenience. We provided factual history that supports this in the separately bound appendix from the professor of American religious history at Vanderbilt. I'm going to mess up his name. I think it's Hednut Bumler, who developed the history of parsonages and how they are used for four religious business reasons for the church. And in fact, the plaintiffs admit, and this is on page 73 of the separately bound appendix, that the parsonage is a critical means for a church to further its church activities and religious purposes. So I think in that sense, the blanket exclusion in 107 is justified for the same secular purposes that other blanket exclusions for housing benefits in the code, which is that if the employee is using the home for the employer's purpose.
Ms. Hagley, would there be any geographic limits on that concept? What I'm thinking of specifically is smaller communities, rural communities, where you might actually have a clergy person servicing three, four different congregations, shall we say. Would that, but there was a, he or she only had one domicile.
That's true, but he still would be serving his church through his home.
It doesn't have to be connected to just one specific.
No, as long as he's been ordained by a church and the housing allowance has been designated.
Ms. Hagley, let me ask you a question that I think may bridge the standing and merits question, okay. And it's one of my concerns here. I understand the plaintiffs eventually conceded they didn't have standing to challenge 107.1 because they didn't receive any in-kind housing.
Correct.
So what we get is an injunction barring, quote, enforcement of 107.2, presumably telling the IRS you can't let anybody else get away with this on a cash allowance. The result of that seems to be that if the district court's order stands, then we have tax law and policy discriminating between different religious organizations depending upon whether they provide in-kind or cash housing.
That's exactly right, and that was the problem that Congress faced in 1954. The purpose of the 107.2 exemption, as you've identified, is to eliminate the discrimination between churches that provided parsonages as in-kind and parsonages through cash. They both serve the same purpose, and in fact, the legislative history is clear that the purpose for that was to eliminate discrimination. A number of denominations had gone to Congress and said, this is, you know, when the original exemption came into play in 1921, most churches in America provided in-kind, and this is detailed in the declaration from the professor. But as more churches were providing the cash allowance for religious reasons for the church's convenience, it did create this discrimination. It was brought to Congress's attention, and what was also brought to Congress's attention is that prior to enacting 107.2, the courts had extended the exclusion to parsonages through cash versus in kind. So in a sense, Congress was merely codifying with the courts that, you know, the leveling of the playing field amongst ministers that the courts had already ordered.
If that sets a pattern for the plasticity of statutory text in this area, then maybe there's some hope for a statutory or an administrative.
Well, you mean the definition of minister of the gospel,
out. And if in-kind housing then can be interpreted by courts to include cash allowances. So.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions?
Apparently not.
Okay, right.
Thank you, Ms. Hagen. Mr. Bolton.
May it please the court. My name is Rich Bolton, and I represent the appellees in this matter, Freedom From Religion Foundation, and the co-presidents of the organization, Annie Lloyd Gaylor and Dan Barker. Let me address sequentially the issues that probably the court will address in the same order and counsel for the government has, and that being, first of all, the standing issue. The argument that the government makes essentially is that there's not really a denial that unequal treatment, if established, would not be an injury that would be recognized for case and controversy standing purposes. The issue that they make is not really that the differential treatment, which the Supreme Court and other courts have consistently recognized, is an injury for purposes of standing. Their argument is really a procedural one. The argument being that you have to go through a process. You have to go. Basically, it's an exhaustion requirement that you are required to go through the IRS in order to adjudicate this issue.
I had sort of understood the argument as being you can only litigate your own taxes, not somebody else's.
Mm-hmm. That's
a pretty broad, important principle in tax administration.
Well,
isn't it?
But the notion. If the argument is that you can't object to a benefit that you don't qualify for, in other words, that a benefit is under inclusive, as the Supreme Court recognized in Arkansas Writers Project, to deny standing on the basis that, well, you can't complain that somebody else is getting a benefit that you don't. The only person that would have standing would be those who are subject to the benefit, and of course those people are not going to object. So in order to contest an under-inclusive statute, you needs must, in a sense, be arguing about a benefit that somebody else is getting that you are not. It's inherent in it. And the notion that you cannot complain about unequal treatment because it may impact on someone else. The suggestion the constitutionality of statutes can only be litigated by those who are subject to it would in fact, as the Supreme Court has consistently recognized, insulate under inclusive statutes.
Mr. Bolton, considering the normally the tax code and various exemptions, what would be the limiting principle then for a citizen to challenge, put aside our case, any benefit that is ascribed by the code through Congress to corporations, whatever? I mean, what would happen to the standing situation?
Right. You know, the issue here is, as the courts have recognized, the fact that a large number of people are excluded from this benefit that are otherwise similarly situated, except for the religious criteria for it, is not a disqualifying factor. Now, in other situations, for instance, let's say that you had a zoning issue that you objected to. It's very unlikely that unless you know you are similarly situated in terms of whatever the zoning issue is, that you're going to have standing. There's not a floodgate issue here. What makes this the concern that I think you have is, well, wouldn't this arguably then allow any employer to designate part of the compensation of an employee, and then that person could take the exemption without any more? Well, the problem here is that that's exactly what the statute permits for ministers. There's the statute does not require that there be any. There's no requirement of convenience of the employer. There's no requirement that the housing be close to the church. There are no limits. All that the church has to do with a cash allowance is designate a portion of it. And so given the absence of any really substantive requirements other than being a minister, those who are similarly situated, it may in fact be a broad group. But it's not because the floodgates are open. It's because the benefit that is being provided to selectively to the ministers here is very broad and without restriction. But in most instances, you're going to have a benefit or a distributive process in which there are more requirements than that.
In light of 107.1, which provides a blanket in kind exclusion, how could we find it unconstitutional for Congress to ensure that religions with a tradition of church-owned houses are not favored over newer religions or those without such a tradition? I mean, isn't the interest in not favoring one religion over another an adequate basis to extend the exclusion to cash allowances?
Well, I think the argument or the concept that you're suggesting is here is if you're going to allow an exemption for people, for ministers who receive in-kind housing, mm-hmm. then isn't it really sort of arbitrary and irrational to deny ministers mm-hmm. A benefit or an equivalent exemption if they receive cash? And that distinction doesn't make any sense. Well, if it doesn't make any sense, let's take a look at what the law provides for secular or non-minister employees. It provides that you can get an exemption for housing provided, in-kind housing provided for the convenience of the employer.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't provide an exemption for cash allowances provided to non-ministers. Now, if that distinction between in-kind and cash allowance aid is recognizable as a rational distinction for non-minister employees, then it's hard to say that it's irrational to distinguish between in-house or in-kind.
It's not a question. Rationality is not necessarily the standard. Right?
Pardon me?
Rationality is not necessarily the standard. If you're talking about allowances for Roman Catholic priests or Presbyterian ministers who live in parsonages or rectories, and you're treating other religious faiths differently, there's a much more demanding standard, right?
I understand. But there is a suggestion buried in the argument that it doesn't make sense and that it is discriminatory to distinguish between churches that provide in-kind versus those that provide cash allowances. And I'm suggesting that it's not irrational. But the other thing that I'd note is that
Does it serve the kind of compelling state interest that would be needed to differentiate between the legal treatment of different faiths?
But in terms of whether, you know, the notion...
Could you answer my question?
Pardon me?
Could you answer my question?
I'm sorry.
Does that difference, does your argument show a compelling governmental interest that would be needed to justify differential legal treatment as between different faiths?
Is the distinction...
There may be a rational basis. I'm asking whether your argument can meet the higher constitutional standard that would apply to differential legal treatment of different faiths.
I don't believe it would constitute a compelling governmental interest, but I'm also not aware of the theory by which the compelling governmental interest would be applicable. Because the Supreme Court has certainly held that with generally applicable neutral laws, that there is not there isn't a requirement of a compelling governmental interest. Now that issue comes up in other contexts under the Religious Land Use and Institutional Persons Act, and this court has said that even under that act, in terms of that we're not going to construe that and require a compelling governmental interest where there would be a situation where you'd actually be engaging in favoritism to religion. So, for instance, in the zoning area, this court has said that to actually give preferences to religion under generally applicable principles would in fact violate the Establishment Clause.
Forgive me. I don't remember which amicus brief it was, but sort of bottom line, one of the amicus briefs noted that the question isn't whether the government must exempt ministers' housing from taxation, but whether it is permitted to do so. And I'd really like you to help me with that.
If I understand your question right, you're saying it may not be required, but we certainly permit some things that are not required. But in this area, you've got a situation where, I go back to Texas Monthly, and Texas Monthly says that unless you've got a benefit that is generally applicable to a wide group of people entities of which the religious category is only one component of it, then you're okay. But benefits that go exclusively on the basis of religious criteria select tax payers is not constitutional. So the wiggle room in the joints, which I think the Supreme Court has sometimes referred to, generally arises in the area of accommodation. And here we're not really dealing with an accommodation issue because this is not a situation where there's a government-imposed burden. The Supreme Court has been consistent. And let me also back up.
Is there with Seaman?
Pardon?
Is there with Seamen, S-E-A-M-E-N?
And your question with regard to Seamen is, I'm not sure I understand what your question is.
Well, is that a governmental problem as you're arguing here?
Well, that's right. And if that Seamen were given a cash allowance, it wouldn't be exempt. So The distinction that you're talking about right now is not one before the court. The distinction, for instance, if the court drew a distinction and said that secular employees could take an exemption for in-kind housing provided for the convenience of the employer, but not for ministers, then I think then you'd have the sort of distinction that you're talking about. But the Seaman situation involves an in-kind type of housing rather than the cash allowance.
In all cases?
Pardon?
In all cases?
In all cases, Your Honor. The law provides, Section 119, and even before that, Section 119 of the Code says that we're using an example of a seaman, and other examples may be healthcare people at hospitals and whatnot, where there's a requirement that you be on the employer's premises for the convenience of the employer. That in-kind housing is not taxable, but the law still remains, and this is the key point here. The distinction still remains that as to cash allowances for the non-minister employee, there is not an exemption for it.
So, for instance, if a ship sunk and the seamen are, I don't know, in Nairobi, and they have to live somewhere, that there'd be no exemption for the money that was put
forward? If they're provided in-kind housing for the convenience of the employer on the employer's premises, then they can claim it as an exemption.
Well, no, now they're on land.
But if they're provided housing, a cash housing allowance, they're not allowed an exemption for that. And the government has argued that, well, Section 280A, C1 of the code provides a deduction for the portion of a house, for instance, that may be used for business purposes. But that's not the same as the cash allowance allowed for ministers, which covers basically all of their housing costs, taxes, mortgage, repair, heating, utilities, and whatnot. But with Section 280, it's number one, it's a deduction rather than an exemption, and number two, It's only for that portion of a premises that is used exclusively for business purposes. So the government's argument that there is, in fact, an exemption for cash allowances made to secular or non-minister employees is simply not the case. The law is, in Your Honor, you look somewhat perplexed that it could be the case that cash housing allowances provided to employees, even seamen and whatnot, would not be exempt. But that is the case.
I always look perplexed.
Pardon?
I always look perplexed.
It's a good look. but that's the point, Your Honor. This is, and whether you're perplexed or not, I'll use you. This is what is perplexing about it, is that you've got this distinction here that is based solely on religious criteria with regard to the cash allowance. With the cash allowance, if an employer provides a cash allowance for housing to cover all those sorts of housing costs that the non-minister has just as much as the minister has, those aren't exempt. But if you're a minister, and there's no requirement under Section 107.2, there's nothing in there that requires a convenience of the employer requirement. It is, and this goes back again to the floodgates argument with regard that Section 107.2, in a sense, is a floodgates asked to ministers because it doesn't ask any questions, except the questions that it does ask are you a church? Are you a minister? Do you perform sacerdotal functions? Do you have a dogma and a religious sign? Do you have congregants? Do you meet regularly? Do you perform religious services? And the government says, well, these are simply fact-checking. And so they don't really constitute entanglement. But it is exactly this fact-checking. The fact-checking is the door.
So
it is the door to allowance for that that exemption.
So, bottom line, you're saying that 107.2 can't be read simply as a codification of all those judicial holdings that give recognition that given the duties of ministers, the housing choice is almost always for the convenience of the employer.
It's a long question.
I know.
I think I agree with you. Let me just say,
if you do, you lose.
Let me just say, with regard to what I think, what you've focused on at times, and I know you have, Your Honor, in terms of the differential treatment among different groups, then among different religious groups, and the notion that there is no requirement, even under the notion, and one, you know, you'll see cases that say one of the most bedrock, impermeable principles is that you can't distinguish under the law among religious groups. But what that doesn't mean that you can't have different criteria for different benefits. It simply means that you can't differentiate on the basis of religious criteria. There's nothing that says that the law has to equally impact different churches in the same way. And here, you don't have a discrimination that I think is recognizable under the Establishment Clause or the Free Exercise Clause. You've got a distinction between in-kind and cash. You're treating both secular. The distinction there is not on the basis of any prohibited religious criteria. And the notion that it's okay to discriminate against or to discriminate in favor of religion so that the law impacts all of them the same, even if you're trying to measure different criteria, is simply not a recognized constitutional principle. Let's see, looks like I've got a couple of minutes left.
No?
Am I done?
No, not until
that's what
light,
I thought.
Mr. Bolton.
Let me go back real quick then to one thing. Number one, on the government says that the inquiries, the fact-checking inquiries to determine whether someone is a church and they're a congregant and they practice, engage in religious services and what's not, it's just fact-checking, and that it is better, or that it, that is far better than determining the convenience of the employer. The notion of the convenience of the employer it doesn't ask any doctrinal questions. It wouldn't ask any doctrinal questions. But the other thing is simply that the government assumes that that is the fallback position. Well, when in fact, as to secular employees who receive a cash allowance, there is no convenience of the government employer inquiry. And similarly, if you eliminate Section 107.2, the fallback is not necessarily convenience of the employer. You would be the same as other employees receiving cash housing allowances. Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Bolton. Ms. Hagley.
Thank you. I just had a few quick points, one with regard to standing and two with regard to the Establishment Clause. With regard to standing, we acknowledge that there would be standing to challenge an under-inclusive statute if they were to seek and be denied the exclusion, just as in Texas Monthly and Heckler, which both concerned under-inclusive statutes. With regard to the Establishment Clause, first of all, counsel brought up that there's no requirement in 107 for the conditions of the employment, convenience of the employer, and the absence of that requirement serves the secular purpose of avoiding potentially intrusive questions by the government into the church's convenience and what's going on in the home, whether particular activity is religious or secular, and this serves some of the same purposes that were served with the ministerial exception that's been adopted by the courts to avoid inquiries into the minister-church relationship, as well as the exemption that was upheld in the Amos case, which wanted the government to refrain from making the dividing line between religious and secular because it's sometimes difficult and would embroil the government in entangling issues. And then finally, the other point I wanted to make was with regard to cash allowances, there are other instances in the code where cash allowances are excluded. Our brief pointed out that cash allowance is provided for the military under Section 134, federal employees living abroad under Section 912. And one of the amicus briefs, I believe it was the brief filed by the Beckett Fund, pointed out that cash allowances provided to employees who have to temporarily relocate for their employer, and that might cover that cash allowance is also excluded from income. I think it's under 162 and 132. But even if there weren't other instances, and there are, the allowance here in 107.2, that exclusion is justified to eliminate discrimination among religions. Are there any other further questions?
Apparently not. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Bolton, thank you. The case is taken under advisement.